You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Anna Sale, host of WNYC's Death, Sex, and Money, sitting in for Leonard Lopate today. Thank you for joining us. Leonard Lauder's recent $1 billion gift of 81 Cubist masterpieces to the Metropolitan Museum of Art made waves and fueled rivalries in the city's museum scene. In a new piece for Vanity Fair, special correspondent Bob Colicello writes about how the Met's major foray into 20th century art is altering the balance of power among the city's biggest museums and inciting a battle between the Met and MoMA for art, prestige, and young moneyed trustees. He also argues this comes at a time where all of the city's major arts institutions are in a time of transition. The story appears in the February issue of Vanity Fair on newsstands January 13th, and I'm pleased that it's brought Bob Colicello to our show. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
The piece is called Might at the Museum, and it begins with a scene celebrating this gift of Leonard Lauder's $1 billion gift of 81 Cubist masterpieces to the Met. And you start by pointing out all of the people in the room clinking glasses and celebrating together. Sounds like it's very, everyone's in this together as you describe the scene.
Well, the art world, especially the museum world, is a pretty civilized place all in all. And we're talking about ladies and gentlemen and wealthy people who love art. I mean, it's not like there's real villains in this piece. There is competition and there is behind the scenes rivalries for sure. But that was a night where the art world came together and where the Metropolitan Museum director Thomas Campbell graciously invited his colleagues from Museum of Modern Art. Glenn Lowry's the director there, and Adam Weinberg, the director of the Whitney. And the piece was really focusing on these three institutions that are all in transitions and expanding. The Whitney is about to open this fabulous new building downtown. And because the Whitney actually decided to move downtown, its old building on Madison Avenue, the Breuer Building, as it's called after its architect, Marcel Breuer, opened up an opportunity for the Metropolitan Museum to have a place to really start showing contemporary art while they're in beginning to completely reconstruct their modern and contemporary galleries in the main museum. So that's kind of was the catalyst of everything in a funny way.
So this piece in a lot of ways is about what it means that the Met is investing big time in contemporary art in New York City. The New York Times called Leonard Lauder's donation a sterling act of philanthropy. What did it mean for him to contribute these works to the Met and not to MoMA?
Well, I think it made more sex. I'm sorry, you said sex, death, and I think you threw me off a little. I think for Leonard Lauder, it made more sense to give the Cubist collection to the Met because MoMA does have one of the great Cubist collections in the world. And perhaps if he gave it to MoMA, he would have felt he was being a bit redundant. The courtship of Leonard by first Philippe de Montebello, the longtime former director of the Met, and then by Tom Campbell, the new director, has gone on for several years. Some people felt because Leonard's younger brother, Ronald Lauder, who is one of the greatest collectors of everything from medieval armor to Austrian art to very contemporary art, people felt the fact that his brother, younger brother, was so associated with MoMA, had been the chairman, is now chairman emeritus, was part of Leonard's decision. Knowing the Lauder family as well as I do, I don't think that's really the case. I think the rivalry between the brothers has been played up. It's something that's kind of sort of matured over the years, or mellowed, shall I say. But it certainly, for the Met, was a huge coup. And did in some ways to take a little luster off the MoMA,
A huge coup. And describe why. Why? What does this add to the Met's collection that was missing?
Well, the Metropolitan Museum is an encyclopedic museum, meaning it goes back to Egypt and Greece and Rome. But it sort of stopped with Impressionism and the early 20th century. It's really lacking in modern and contemporary, meaning 20th century art, essentially. For a brief period in the 1960s, when Henry Gelzhaler was a director of the Contemporary Art Department, did the Met seem to take an active interest in the new art, you know, and art of the last century, 20th century. So there's big gaps to fill, and the Lauder gift fills a huge gap, the Cubist gap, and now it stimulates giving on the part of other collectors of modern art, of whether it's Picasso or whether it's Jackson Pollock and de Kooning or Andy Warhol and Jeff Koons. It shows that the Met is really now, with the new curators it's hired, with the commitment to greatly expanding the galleries within the museum, with the old Whitney building, that the Met is, you know, is now a big player in 20th century art. And that MoMA almost had that turf to itself for a long time and has the greatest collection of 20th century art in the world.
And so that is changing. And you mentioned the Whitney's move downtown and how that, the arrangement with the Met for new gallery space for contemporary art. What are the details of that deal? How did that get worked out?
Well, it was basically worked out by Adam Weinberg, the director of the Whitney, and Tom Campbell. But it was initiated, the discussions were initiated by Leonard Lauder, who is chairman emeritus of the Whitney, with Philippe de Montebello. And everyone involved says there was no quid pro quo, you know. Leonard Lauder did not say to the Met, you know, if you want my Cubist collection, you have to lease the Breuer
the old
building,
Whitney
the old Whitney building. Because Leonard has a great fondness for the Whitney building. It is a great architectural gem. And while most of his board was gung-ho about moving downtown, he was not. So there was a lot of intrigue there, but it all worked out as very well. It's a win-win for both institutions. The way that affects MoMA, though, is now the Whitney's new building, which I've had a tour of, it gives them five times the amount of space to show not only their permanent collection of American 20th century art, but to have much bigger shows and much more actively seek gifts and acquisitions of contemporary art. So MoMA's kind of getting it from both sides in a way, you know, because what it comes down to is, having not only wealthy trustees, but trustees who are serious art collectors and who will make donations or chip in to buy new artworks. And there's we all know how expensive modern and contemporary art has become. So it's a very high stakes game, and a lot of it is based on perception and based on ego and collectors want to know their paintings are going to be well shown and also personal relationships between the directors of these museums, the trustees, the artists, the galleries. It's like any business. In the end, it comes down to personalities.
And that's what's so intriguing about your piece, because you are part of this scene, you are part of this world, and so we get to see some of the actors behind these big moves. Whitney moving downtown, the Met having this new place to show art in the Whitney's old building, this new Cubist art at the Met. Meanwhile, MoMA is dealing with a controversy about its planned renovation and architectural designs that have caused controversy not only publicly but also on its board. What did you find about where MoMA is in terms of its leadership?
Well, the thing about MoMA is their last expansion, this building by Taniguchi, a Japanese architect, has not worked out as well as everyone hoped and thought in the beginning. Their circulation problems, they're almost a victim of their own success in attracting such a huge public. But I think there is a kind of division in the art world between people who like painting and sculpture and objects and people who like performance art and installation art. And there's a feeling, I think, that MoMA, in particular its curator at large, Klaus Biesenbach, you know, are very much about performance art, and that the initial plan for the new expansion of MoMA was going to make the whole first floor almost like a performance art space and open the garden to the public free of charge. That caused a big brouhaha. as well as the destruction of the Museum of Folk Art, which was sort of in the way of MoMA's current building, and where the apartment tower going up next door. And so that got a lot of bad press for MoMA. One should add right away that that plan is being revised, and we won't know until late February or March what they're really going to do.
You do have a bit of reporting in your piece, however, that a board member says the trustees do not want the first floor to be open to the public for free.
Yeah, that's what Ronald Lauder said, and other trustees have said they're against it. But it has not really, as far as I know, come to a vote. And as I said, the plan is still being designed by Dilla Scofidio and Renfro, who did the Lincoln Center redesign. I interviewed Liz Dilla. They're fantastic architects, and I think if anyone could solve the problem of MoMA's circulation and all of that, it will be them. The piece also goes into, you know, where my reporting led me, which is that Glenn Lowry is just not as popular as Tom Campbell is.
Glenn Lowry running the MoMA versus
yes,
Tom Campbell.
Yes, he's been there
at the
20
Met.
Years, and, you know, he got off to a rocky start by losing. I don't know if ousting's the word or if it was, but basically he did not get along with Kirk Varnadeau, who was a long time a top curator at MoMA, who was ill with cancer and who ended up leaving and dying 2 years later. There was another great curator there, Rob Storr, who then left because of disagreements with Glenn Lowry. And I think it's strange how those were, in a way, they become like Pyrrhic victories for Glenn Lowry, because if you Google him, there's still articles being written as late as last year. There's a huge piece in New York Review of the Books, rehashing all of this conflict. And both Kirk Varnadeau and Rob Storr are beloved, and especially by some members of the MoMA board. But you know, again, as I said, it comes down to personalities. Glenn Lowry's a perfectly nice guy, but he's perceived as being, a bit of a control freak. And you know, he did a great job getting the new building built. But I quote other people, and it's been out there for a long time that he's controversial. Whereas Tom Campbell seems to be handling himself so far, he's 6 years in, as the arch diplomat. He's out at openings all over town. He's very low key. He doesn't come across as the slightest bit arrogant or full of himself. And he's winning converts among collectors, among artists, among the gallery people. And so that's something, you know, that's a reality, I think, for MoMA.
And everything is going the Met's way, this at least in this moment, it appears, with
yes.
the new building moving into
no,
the
No, and what many people have said, everything seems, all the plans that Tom Campbell's talking about, and that Sheena Wagstaff, who's the new curator of Modern and Contemporary, and has a great reputation coming from the Tate Modern in London, their plans sound good, but let's now see if they can execute them, you know, so it's not a done deal. And one has to reiterate that MoMA is a fantastic museum, and Glenn Lowry's there for another 5 years, and it's got a very strong board, and they're very supportive of him for the most part. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, things will go, how the pendulum swings, let's put it that way.
Let's talk about the board, because that's also in this piece. There's a lot in yeah. this piece. The
I should have had twice as much space to tell you the truth.
The board at MoMA, there's an interesting question in your piece, which is, who is an appropriate trustee for a major arts institution in New York City? Is it enough to just be a very wealthy person, or must you also be an art collector and educated about art? And there's been some criticism about MoMA's board that there's been a lot of emphasis on the money part.
Well, MoMA's board, there's lots of billionaires on the board, but overall, it's wealthy, you know, wealthy people who support the museums.
Right, it's hard to draw.
You know,
those
we live
lines.
In a country where the government does not support the museums. I think it's better. I mean, I think it's better to have individual collectors having some say than some anonymous bureaucrats in Washington. But, you know, if you look at the MoMA board, I mean, there are people like Ronald Perlman, who's a big collector. He went on recently, and I would say is very passionate about art. Leon Black, who's on both the MoMA and Met boards, is a great connoisseur of everything from Renaissance drawings to contemporary things and a passionate collector. But there are some people, I guess, who the sense is they're just there for their money. And the MoMA board used to have the old MoMA board. There were more people who were moderately wealthy, but actually knew a lot about art and whose social life revolved around artists. And I mean, but there are not many that many people who you can hold to that standard. I think the criticism of the MoMA board being too rich is really not so fair. It's the other museum boards, you know, are not exactly made up of paupers. So, but I think you do want some people on a board. Jamie Niven is on the MoMA board. He's not a billionaire. He's the chief auctioneer at Sotheby's, but he knows a lot about art, and he's been there for, and film is his specialty. He's been there for like 30 years. You need some people that are a little more creative types on any creative cultural institutions board, I think.
And as the Met makes a major move into modern 20th century art, there's also, you write about it, a competition for younger trustees. And young, you say in the piece, in museum years is under 60. Yeah. And so how is that playing out? What's that look like?
Well, in my opinion, and I think in the opinion of so many people around town, because you have to realize before I started writing this piece, I've known all about this for a long time. I mean, I started working for Andy Warhol at Interview Magazine when I was 23 years old. So I know these players a long time, and I go to dinner parties and you hear, you know, the talk. The Met, and I think one of the things that makes people think this sort of more glamour, more buzz around the Met, has secured two of the greatest, I would say, young leaders of their generation. And by that I mean sort of the 40-year-olds. One is Alejandro Santo Domingo, who's from a very distinguished Colombian family, whose father and mother are big modern art collectors, and who himself is also collecting, and is just one of those charismatic people that people tend to follow. So he was a big get for the Met. The other is Samantha Boardman Rosen, who's married to A.B. Rosen, who happens to be a huge collector of Warhols and Basquiat's and Koons. But she herself is a psychiatrist. She's from very old money families on both sides. She's not a girl who had to go out and become spend 13 years becoming a psychiatrist. She's very charismatic. She's chaired Aggie Gunn's charity events for a studio and a school. And she's taking a very active role there with their chairman's council, which brings in collectors who pay a certain amount each year to have kind of special privileges. And some of these then become board members. So between Alejandro Santo Domingo and Samantha Boardman Rosen, they've got two of the real superstars of the 40-year-old generation.
The emergent philanthropy class.
The emerging, and both of whom grew up with art, love art, live with art. You know, they're really dream trustees for any museum.
When you quote Campbell and Lowry, the Met and MoMA, talking about how it could be okay if the Met moves into the space that's traditionally been sort of ruled by MoMA, the Met talks about bringing in contemporary or 20th century modern art and saying, this is what we do, is we show this art in context, in the context of art history. What MoMA does is shows it in the context of today.
Right.
You say that, then you also point out that until December, when MoMA opened the Forever Now exhibit of 17 painters, there hadn't been a survey exhibition of contemporary painting mounted at MoMA in several decades. Do you think this is creating a little criticism that there needs to be more emphasis at MoMA about the art of now, the art of today?
Well, no, MoMA has been focused on the art of today, and they've had individual painters' shows. I mean, and that Robert Gober, who's primarily a sculptor, is on now. But not having a survey of new painting for so long, yes, generated a lot of animosity and criticism among the part of the art world. You know, someone said to me, which was too late to get into the story, that the art market is essentially the painting market. Because collectors want to buy something. You can't buy Marina Abramović performance. And the feeling is that I mean, in general, curators, critics, I would say the intellectuals in the art world, have for a long time favored conceptual art, installation art, difficult art, performance art, whereas the market, the galleries, the auction houses, and the
collectors.
The collectors favor painting and sculpture. They want something to put over the sofa, in the crudest terms. So there is this inherent division. And I think MoMA, a lot of the criticism of MoMA is not personal and is not about Glenn so much, although people feel Glenn favors Klaus Biesenbach over maybe some of the other curators whose departments are painting and sculpture. And so it's a complicated thing. You know, it's working on what's going on involves a lot of issues. I think the Met, I think Tom Campbell's sincere when he says we're not going head-to-head with MoMA. We will do contemporary art shows that integrate it into our collections. I mean, they're thinking of doing an African, contemporary African art exhibition that will incorporate the whole history of African art. We'll see. It all remains to be seen. I think the Met definitely has the edge now in perceptions and in the race for trustees, and especially younger trustees, and we'll see what happens.
We've talked about the Met, we've talked about MoMA, we've talked about the Whitney. We've not mentioned the Guggenheim, and you have a line in your piece that made me laugh out loud. Do you know what line I'm talking about?
Yeah, I said they're not part of this equation because their expansion plans are in Abu Dhabi. Probably there should have been a little more about the Guggenheim. But this piece was written, Graydon Carter gave me the assignment sort of November 1st. In between was Thanksgiving, Miami Art Basel. I couldn't cover the Guggenheim as well, I'll be very frank with you. But I do think that it doesn't really figure into these three museums that are all expanding. The Guggenheim is not expanding in New York. It remains to be seen also whether, again, American collectors, European collectors will make big gifts or help fund acquisitions for museums in the Middle East. That's a whole other subject, you know, I think. And it's just too hard to get Abu Dhabi in there, too.
Yeah, I mean, and it is true. The Met, MoMA, and the Whitney, as you lay out on your piece, are all in this moment of major transition. You talk about a gut renovation that the Met is planning to incorporate this new contemporary art. So it's worth pointing out that MoMA is a little bit ahead of having, you know, there are architectural designs on the table that people can argue about. The Met, those designs aren't there to argue
about. That's
right.
That's a good point, too. They might upset people, too. The MoMA has a difficult situation because of its location. I mean, it's right in the middle of Midtown, and there's not the kind of space that you have in the middle of Central Park. Not that the Met's going to be able to take over parts of the park, but they do have a much larger site and a much larger building to start off with. I think it's, you know, going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. The Whitney, if the Whitney had not decided to move downtown, though, it would have made it much more difficult for the Met to sort of jump in feet first into the contemporary art world, because their new building's like 5 years off. So it's only because they could get the Breuer building, the old Whitney building, that they can right away start providing a space to show new acquisitions and gifts from trustees, which puts the pressure on MoMA, let's say, 5 years before it would have been otherwise. And that's why the Whitney, I think, plays a very pivotal role in this.
Yes, so many changes happening right at this moment. It's a fascinating piece. It's called Might at the Museum. It appears in the February issue of Vanity Fair. Special correspondent Bob Colicello, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.